This is Professor Burke's criminal law class on the 4th of November in room 238.
Is there any requirement that I have all its criminal procedure one? It's
yeah.
Not two, it's not continue.
Even, right, they're separate, so you can take either one.
Yeah, but you are teaching one, two, right? The beginning one.
Yeah, in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great.
She doesn't get 16, she got a 10.
Hey, hi.
Can I usually get out of jail free card?
Yes, remind me your last name.
Walter. You're at the bottom.
Than usual. Okay, I was looking at what we needed to cover today. And what I would like to propose, if it's okay with you, is we usually take our break at 7, right? So I would like to skip the break, but then let you go 25 minutes earlier, which is a 2-for-1, more than 2-for-1 trade. Is that okay with you guys? All right. So I think we can get through what I plan to do in that time. I felt when we left class last time that you guys had walked into the classroom clear on accomplice liability and had left the classroom murky about accomplice liability, which I take as a measure of a bad day for me if I made you more confused by being in the classroom for 50 minutes. That is not a good thing. But it came, I got the sense that the confusion came about when we were looking particularly at this question, the distinction between a defendant who might have the purpose to aid conduct, but not have the purpose of the result of that conduct, right? So Etzweiler intends to help his friend drive, right? He assists that conduct, but he did not have the purpose to cause the result of that conduct. He certainly didn't mean to cause the death of the person that Etzweiler killed through drunk driving. And then the question becomes, okay, so then what? Is he an accomplice or not? We saw that way that the Etzweiler court dealt with it, right? They interpreted the requirement that he assist conduct, that he have the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense. The New Hampshire court interpreted that as literally the criminal offense, which was a homicide, meaning that he had to have the purpose of promoting death, which he clearly did not have. But we also saw, as I told you, that New Hampshire, the legislature, corrected that. The legislature said, court, you're wrong on that. And in fact, we all, I think, kind of agreed that the New Hampshire court had gotten that wrong because the New Hampshire statute exactly tracks the language, that's what I'm trying to do, of the Model Penal Code, which addresses this exact situation in 4, subsection 4 of 2.06. When causing a particular result in an element of an offense, an accomplice in the conduct that causes such result. The conduct, not the result. An accomplice to the conduct is an accomplice in the commission of that offense if he acts with a kind of culpability, if any, with respect to that result that is sufficient for the commission of the offense. In other words, it requires that the defendant aid the conduct, one, and then two, have the mens rea for the offense that he's charged with. Okay, so on that reading of the statute, the defendant who hands his drunk friend the keys, he's an accomplice in the conduct, right? He aided the defendant's, the principal's conduct, and he did so with negligence with respect to human life. Okay, that would make him guilty of criminally negligent homicide. I think the way to clear this up, and I think I got you guys even more confused when I started talking about the New York statute. The New York statute really has the same result, I think, but with different statutory language. New York Section 20 of the Penal Law says when one person engages in conduct which constitutes an offense, that's our principle, another person is criminally liable for such conduct when acting with the mental culpability required for the commission thereof, okay, the offense that he's charged with,
He solicits requests, commands, and importunes, or for our purposes, it's important. He intentionally aids such person to engage in such conduct. And I refer to this as a dual mens rea requirement, and I think that's where I got you guys confused. My point was that if you were to take the New York statute and break it down into elements, you would see a mental state component twice, right? You would, the government would have to prove, and let's stay with the Etzweiler facts. Okay. Defendant hands keys to his drunk friend kills someone. You, if you broke that down into elements, you'd have mental state come up twice if he's charged with criminally, if the person who handed the keys, okay, not the principal, the accomplice. If he's charged with criminally negligent homicide, the government would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt he intentionally aided the principal to engage in his conduct. And two, the defendant would have had to act with the mental culpability required for the commission of criminally negligent homicide, right? He would have had to fail to perceive a substantial and unjustified risk that a reasonable person would have recognized. Okay. You had to be negligent with respect to death. You'd see mental state twice. I think maybe a better way to get this to be intuitive for you is to go back and remind you that accomplice liability is not a separate offense. It is a theory of liability. When someone is charged as an accomplice to criminally negligent homicide, they are being charged with negligent homicide. It's not a separate offense of being an accomplice. They are charged with negligent homicide. One way to look at the way the New York statute works is, of course, the defendant has to act with the mental culpability required for the commission of that offense. He's been charged with it. We are in inchoate liability land because we can't prove the act. Right? We can't prove that the person who handed the drunk the keys was the cause of death. The actus reus of negligent homicide is causing the death of another person. We can't prove that he's the cause of that. One way of thinking of accomplice liability is it relaxes causation. The drunk might have borrowed a car from someone else. They might have killed the guy anyway. Okay, we can't prove the actus reus on the part of the person who handed the keys. Instead, we resort to a theory of liability that attributes the driver's conduct to the accomplice. It is a theory of liability that takes the principal's act and attributes it to the defendant for purposes of proving the actus reus of the substantive offense. If that is more appealing to you than the way I explained it as two different mens rea requirements, this is the way I would look at the statute. The mental culpability required for the commission of the offense, of course you have to prove that. The government always has to prove that. The rest of this stuff is the theory of liability. It is the relaxed actus reus component of it. You can't prove that the defendant was the cause of death. That's why you're looking at accomplice liability. And what accomplice liability does is say, and I'm trying to make this intuitive. For me, it's intuitive because I've done it so long. But if I'm assisting conduct, I lose the right to say I distance myself from the very conduct that I facilitated. Right? If I hand that person the keys and it leads to him driving down the street drunk, that is my conduct, just as if I had driven the car. If I'm the wheelman for the robbers inside, I am helping them. Who am I to say I have nothing to do with what happened inside the liquor store? I am aiding it, and therefore it becomes my conduct. It is a theory of liability. It takes the principal's conduct and makes the accomplice responsible for it as if it was his own conduct. And what the New York statute does is precisely that. It says that if you intentionally aid another person's conduct, that conduct is yours for the actus reus part of the statute. And then the defendant must also have the mental culpability required for that offense. So if it's criminally negligent homicide, he has to have acted with negligence with respect to the victim's death. And then he has to have aided the conduct that led to the death. That conduct becomes his, okay, because he intentionally aided it. Look at the exercise that we were going to do last week that we didn't get to as an example of this. Mondello. Closing this all up now. Hopefully you guys still have this. Yeah. How many of you remember when this happened? A few of you. I kind of remember when this happened. I didn't live in New York, but it was a case all over the national news at the time. And clearly a very different New York. I mean, I'm sure that even if you don't remember this case, you know that New York used to have much higher crime and much worse race relations than what you find now. And why can't I find this one? So Yusuf Hawkins had gone to a predominantly Italian-American neighborhood. He's African-American. And wound up getting into the middle of something he had nothing to do with until this gang of, you know, worked up people from the neighborhood chased him down the street and wound up beating him, and then he was shot and murdered. And the question was, you know, whom to charge and whom to convict on the basis of this. And Mondello is the person that the evidence suggested had kind of organized this group of people saying, get him, and had even passed out weapons for people to chase him down the street and had been the ringleader of much of this chaos. Do you guys have the handout? Does anybody need a copy? So the first question that I had put to you was, assume that Mondello is charged with depraved indifference murder as opposed to intentional murder. Extreme reckless murder, depraved indifference murder. And then Hawkins died, Yusuf Hawkins died from severe injuries attributable to physical beating, not a shooting. Take the gun out of it for a second. Could, at that point, Mondello be convicted under Section 20? As an accomplice, even if he's not the one who inflicts the fatal blow. Yeah.
I think so, because he's the one who handed out the baseball bats and rounded up the army of 30 people. So they acted with a common purpose and certainly made the offense more likely. And I think he had the mens rea.
Okay, what's the mens rea for the crime charged? If it's depraved indifference murder, he has that, right?
Yes, he would have a reckless depraved indifference to human life.
Okay, so here is...
He would have baseball bats and get inside the crowd together.
Yeah, so I think that's the reason why I started with that is I think that's the simplest variation on the facts. You've kind of got to fictionalize it to make it simple. And if you make it simple, it's intentional murder. Sorry, it's not intentional murder. It's depraved indifference murder. And it's not a shooting. It's the baseball bat that he was handing out, right? Well, did he intentionally aid the prince, our fictional principal at this point, to engage in such conduct? Sure, right? He's the one who handed them the bats and encouraged them to do it. Did he act with the mental culpability required for depraved indifference murder? David said, sure, I'm pretty confident the prosecutor would be able to prove that to a jury, right? There's no socially redeemable reason to be handing out bats and telling somebody to go get this guy. That's the most straightforward variation that we see here. Now, using the actual facts where Yusuf Hawkins was shot, and they can't tie Mondello to the gun. Does Mondello meet the requisite act and mens rea requirements under Section 20 then? What would the jury have to believe? For that to be true. So now our principal is the shooter. When one person engages in conduct which constitutes an offense, another person is criminally liable for such conduct. When acting with the mental culpability required for the commission thereof, he intentionally aids such a person. Now we're changing it to a shooting. And the charge is still depraved indifference. Yeah. Rich?
I would say yes.
Okay, so you're saying he intentionally aided the attack, right? He might not have been involved in a gun, he might not have said shoot him, but he was engaged, he intentionally aided the attack that led to his death. And then what about the mental culpability, if it's depraved indifference murder? Okay, it's the same, right, that we just walked through. If you're handing out bats saying get him, and there's no reason for that, that's a pretty good case of depraved indifference murder. Does somebody want to take another position on that? Somebody think that it's a harder case to prove against Mondello when we changed it to the shooting? Fiddleman? Okay, so I think the reason why it gets complicated when we take the actual facts where Hawkins is shot, that's the cause of death, but we can only tie Mondello to weapons and physical beating and not shooting, is the defense is going to take the position that such conduct that the defendant has to intentionally aid is the shooting, right? Such conduct refers back up to the principal engaging in conduct which constitutes an offense. Well, the question is, well, what's the conduct which constitutes an offense? Is it a shooting? In which case, you can't intentionally aid a shooting that the government can't prove you knew about. Or is it an attack? Defined more generally, the bigger picture about the assault upon this person, chasing him, taking away his chances of survival by chasing him, making it easier for him to shoot. If you depict the conduct which constitutes an offense more broadly, then Mondello did intentionally aid that. Okay. I think the court, the trial court, implicitly answered this question that you guys have identified. What's the conduct constituting the offense that the defendant has to intentionally aid? Is it the shooting or is it the attack more broadly? At one point, the jury asked the question, does he have to know the shooter? Does he have to know about the shooter? And what did the court say? Is that in your book? You scared me for a second.
They said no.
Okay, the judge answered the question no and gave this analogy, right, to a symphony orchestra playing together. They can assist each other without knowing what the other one is doing, right, these waves. He gives a sports analogy. Okay, but implicitly what he was saying is the conduct constituting the offense was the bigger picture, not just the shooting. And that was what Mondello intentionally aided, and he acted with the mental culpability required for the commission of depraved indifference murder. Okay. Next question on here. What if Mondello were charged as an accomplice to intentional murder? What mental state would he have for the jury to convict?
Jury has to prove that he had an intent that we just whatever activity he may have done was intentional, I think.
Right. An intent about causing the death of another person, right?
He intended the death, and I think that would be very hard.
Yes. Okay. So, precisely right. So, to convict him of purposeful murder, he has to act with the mental culpability required for that substantive offense. Okay. Purpose to kill. So I think you guys were, I could tell that I hated letting you leave Thursday because I could tell you were confused, but I also knew that you didn't want to stay an extra hour and talk to me about it. But I don't think you're as confused as you left looking on Thursday. New York Section 20 requires the mental state that's required for the commission of the offense, and then it's a theory of liability. If the defendant has intentionally aided his principal's conduct, that conduct is treated as his. Okay. It is a way to get around the actus reus that he would have to, the government would otherwise have to prove if they didn't resort to accomplice liability. They just charge the defendant without resorting to 20 in this example. Another example to give you guys a more clear feeling for this, to make it a little more intuitive. Let's stick with Mondello. In our hypothetical, I guess it's not really a hypothetical, looking at B, right, the actual facts were Mondello, they can't prove that he's the shooter, they can't even prove that he knew about the shooting, but he hands out bats. Okay. The person who shoots Yusuf Hopkins, what is he probably guilty of? Is this one hard?
Intentional murder.
Intentional murder, right? Most likely. You know, unless he were to argue the gun went off accidentally or he was only aiming for the guy's foot. You know, we'd have to make kind of crazy theories. But usually when a person shoots another person and that person died, it's not that hard to prove intentional murder. Okay, purposeful murder. Is that necessarily what Mondello is guilty of? No, not at all, right? We just said proving intentional murder might be difficult. Proving depraved indifference murder is not difficult at all. Let's change the facts still further. Mondello doesn't hand out bats. All he does is tell everybody in the neighborhood this false story about Yusuf Hopkins being a bad guy and they should, you know, somebody should gang up on him. That's all he does. Somebody winds up shooting Yusuf Hopkins. And Mondello told these people to chase him down the street, that he was there, where he was, where he could be found. What's the shooter guilty of? Still, intentional murder, right? What might Mondello be guilty of? Yeah. Wait, who's he conspiring against? Not if it's not his purpose to kill. It would be conspiracy if he reached an agreement. I think then we're making up all kinds of facts. Yeah, Rich? So he might argue, if he's going for broke, he's going to argue, no act, I had nothing to do with this, I have no duty to protect him. What's the government going to say in response to that? Ben, what were you going to say? Okay, so you might argue, the government might try to argue reckless manslaughter, right? Ordinary garden variety reckless manslaughter. Maybe he didn't show extreme indifference to human life, but when he was telling all these people that Yusuf Hopkins was a bad guy and could be found and where they could find him, if the jury thinks that he averted to a substantial and unjustifiable risk that Hopkins would die as a result of that, and he did it anyway, that would be the culpability required for reckless manslaughter. Right? If he didn't subjectively avert to it, but he should have, it would be negligent homicide, right? But what about this point that, Rich, are you the one who said no duty? Where's his act? Did he commit an act? Okay, he turned this crowd on. He told them that's an act. Okay, that is something affirmative. Now the question is that an act enough to be an accomplice? Did he intentionally aid those people to engage in the conduct that leads to Yusuf Hopkins' death? Sure, he's taking away, right? He's making it more likely it's going to happen by saying, there he is, go get him. Okay. So I think that you guys get this. It seems to me, I'm feeling more comfortable. You guys feeling more comfortable?
Yeah. So is there a difference if he actually physically handed out baseball bats or just inside of the crowd to attack?
I think so, yes. Why?
I actually don't think so. That's why I'm asking.
I think it makes a difference to his mens rea. If all he does is incite the crowd verbally, I think it's harder to show a depraved indifference to human life. It might be a depraved indifference to his well-being. It might make him an accomplice to an assault. But whether it makes him an accomplice to murder, right, the mental culpability required for the commission thereof, if he is accused of depraved indifference murder, And the only thing the government can prove is that verbally he said, "Oh, this is a bad guy, we should beat him up." That might be beat him up with fists. When you start talking about beating up somebody with a baseball bat, the likelihood of their death skyrockets. I think it shows a difference in their mens rea.
It's easier to prove if he verbally accepted God as opposed to just physically handing them back.
No. It's easier to prove a depraved indifference to human life than handing someone a baseball bat. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I think that's more on the actus reus element. For the mens rea element, I would have to say that to verbally incite the crowd is...
It's one thing to verbally incite the crowd. If he says, go kill him, that's a stronger argument that he has depraved indifference to human life, because remember, it's about death. It's not just about an assault or something. Then if he's saying, we should get that guy. Because he could say at that point, I just thought we'd beat him up.
Right,
if he's saying, I just thought we'd beat him up, and he's handing out baseball bats, the likelihood of the defendant dying from being beaten up skyrockets. It becomes easier for the government to prove depraved indifference. I think the point that you're making, though, is a well-taken one. This is a matter of degree. It's not like I can put a spectrum on here and put a line in the middle of it and say, okay, he's guilty of murder on this side of the line, and he's guilty of something else on that side of the line. It's a matter of a degree in terms of the strength of the evidence. Okay, but I think, prosecutors would much rather have a case involving him handing out weapons than one in which he's saying kind of generic things. Maybe to make that more clear, consider the second part of this, the liability of someone in the crowd. He chases them. He's kind of a participant in this mob scene, and then stands by while Hawkins was killed. If he's charged with depraved indifference murder, and Hawkins dies from being beaten up, okay, with baseball bat, should the bystander, as part of that crowd, be convicted? Yeah.
No, the bystander doesn't have a duty to prevent.
Okay, so if we had somebody who watched, if I change the wording of this question, and somebody is on the street and watches all this happen and doesn't help, doesn't intervene, and in fact enjoys watching it, no duty. You're allowed to be a callous bystander. Does the fact, BJ, that this person chased Hawkins make a difference?
Yes, that would have made a difference because now he's a part of the problem, so there is. I think that would be probably involuntary manslaughter.
Okay, so if I take out the word intent to aid, intentionally aid. A person who chases apes, right? They make it less likely that Hawkins is going to get away. They make it more likely that Hawkins is going to die. It's like tally, right? They've contributed to the likelihood of it happening. The wrinkle is whether that ape was given intentionally, right? It's a question of whether or not the defendant intended to aid in that entire picture, or whether their argument is going to be, I'm no different than a bystander, I just had to run along to get a better view, right? If they just happen to be running along to watch, that would make it not intentional aid. It would deprive them of the mental culpability for murder, right? If instead they're chasing, that's different. That's intentionally aiding. If their goal is to help, is to make it so Hawkins can't get away and is subject to this beating, that's intentional aid.
What if, when the drunk driving case, if the guy intentionally aided the drunk driver, if I gave my friend my car to drive home the drunk driver, and if he decides to go on a killing spree and intentionally kill on his way home,
yep.
If I negligently gave him the, my negligently, if I was negligent and knew that some people give it to the keys because that's the result,
then would I be found guilty of negligent homicide, even though he was intentionally killed?
Yes. The whole purpose of this, and remember, accomplice liability is only a theory of liability. It's a way to take one person's act and attribute it to the defendant. The defendant's own liability turns on his mental state. The principal's liability turns on the principal's mental state. So in your, it's a good example, right? So in your example, the driver of the car intentionally, purposefully, starts plucking people off, right? He's going to be charged with intentional murder, purposeful murder. He might try to use voluntary intoxication to rebut that or something like that, but he's going to have his own issues on intentional murder. The person who hands him the keys, it's a slam dunk in his favor on intentional murder. He didn't commit intentional murder. The question is, what was his mental state? He did aid the principal's conduct by handing him the keys. The question is, what was his mental state? Now, one thing I could correct you on is you said if he's negligent about death, if he knows he's taking a risk and does it anyway, those two are not synonymous. If he knows he's taking a risk and does it anyway, what's that? That's reckless. Okay. If he's reckless, he's reckless. That would be manslaughter under the model penal code. If he's only negligent under the model penal code, that would be negligent homicide. What's important to me is that you can distinguish between the differences between negligent and recklessness, and importantly, understand that the defendant's liability could be very different than the principal's. Okay, good. So that's, I think that is the hardest part of complicity, is this point that the accomplice might have a different mental state than the principal. This question of what if they aid the conduct but not the result of the conduct. This stuff is hard. I don't mean to make it sound like it's simple. It's not, but I think you guys understand it more than you thought you did last week. Yeah.
I just have a general question. If someone acts with a common purpose and has the mens rea of even extreme recklessness towards somebody's death, but they die of a different mechanism, like the crowd is chasing with a baseball bat and someone falls off the roof accidentally and kills him, or someone comes and shoots him and nobody knows about it, I don't know how they can have someone. Isn't that a breakdown in the requirements for punishment there? Because I'm having a problem figuring out if an angry crowd is baseball bats chasing someone and someone comes and shoots them, how anyone in that crowd can be responsible for that. They didn't intend that result. And they're not really encouraging.
Mandela would not have been convicted if the trial court had answered that question differently.
Because the model penal code doesn't allow natural and probable results to be imposed on the actor.
Right.
So I just.
Although the model penal code does tend to emphasize mental state above all else, and this requires the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he acted with the requisite mental state, the question is, at what point can you attribute the principal's conduct back to the defendant? A perfectly reasonable argument on this statutory language would be to say the conduct which constitutes an offense in the actual case where Hawkins died of a shooting is the shooting. And the government should have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mandela intentionally aided that conduct, the shooting. When he answered the question to the jury saying he doesn't even have to know someone's got a gun, he clearly was taking a much broader view of what the conduct was. And I'm not, there's no magic, there's no...
That, maybe that's a wrong jury instruction. It looks like even the court watched the victim.
The great thing about statutory interpretation is you can argue both ways. And one thing I want, just like Etzweiler came up with a reasonable argument, sort of, I guess, enough so to convince, you know, a high court in New Hampshire. The legislature was like, that's not what we meant at all. Let us spell out for you in more detail what we meant. In other words, this is not, the court's interpretation of the statute in Hawkins was not one that led to, he appealed his conviction, but on different grounds, not on those grounds. I don't mean to say that there's any definitive cases that in any single jurisdiction, let alone across the board and in the many jurisdictions, that would be binding on this question. This is an exercise for a reason. It's a tough one. Okay. All right. Okay. And that's what lawyers do, right, is you argue both sides of things, and sometimes you get inconsistencies. But if you recognize both sides of that argument, I think you're good. Okay. Well, I think a lot, I mean, if you look at the ACOA case, right, I think some of those people who were charged and acquitted would argue that that's all they did, right? That they were at this big political protest and everything went wrong and they just happened to get swept up, but they were acquitted. Are you going to speak to this?
Yeah. Say that
the original intent was obviously based on that
protest
guy that
protest
presence and yeah, I mean, the
additionally, I was thinking of the reverse. What if because they couldn't really, I don't remember exactly, but I was pretty sure they didn't prove that the one who shot him, I guess. Right, they didn't prove.
They weren't able to, I mean, they had a theory of who they thought was the shooter, and then that was rejected.
Right.
So for our purposes, we have to assume that the government wasn't able to prove who shot the defendant.
Right, so
it could have been somebody else.
Could have been
somebody else. I guess, sure, in theory. Although, I do think... Yeah. So it's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around that, that somebody totally unrelated comes around and shoots them. That's probably not the case. But I think Lee to answer your question... And to make his question seem real, right, if you had a very politically unpopular cause, you know, it's a KKK rally or something, the one African-American person who walks down the street winds up getting shot, and it was a very raucous KKK rally, it wouldn't surprise me if there was a desire on the part of the community to sweep those people up and charge them with something. The issues that are going to come up are, one, BJ's issue of no duty, right? So the question is, what even is your act? Right, was there any act at all? If the only act is speech, the blind shake case that's in your book in the notes, Rahman, the site Bradenburg, right? I'm not a First Amendment expert on this, but speech can't be the basis for complicity or conspiracy unless it's incitement, right? Unless it's intended to incite a crowd. So just being there doing politically protected speech, Lee, would not be the basis for an act, right? And then on top of that, even if there could be some theory of an act like chasing the victim, right, there still has to be the mental state required for the substantive offense. So no, it's not automatic that somebody would be guilty of that. Might it happen, and might there be litigation over that, depending on the political circumstances? Sure, but in theory, the doctrine protects a person from being convicted just from mere presence. Right, mere presence is not enough.
So since there doesn't have to be a principal conviction in order to get someone on a theory of maybe defending something like that,
right?
In theory, can't the prosecution pick and choose whether it's going to go after the defendant now, you know, possibly they want to have a scene and things like that? Like,
yes. Yes, but whatever they prosecute the alleged accomplice for, whatever substantive offense they try to punish him for, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had the requisite mental state for that offense and then intentionally aided the principal.
Can they assume more than one theory?
Oh, you're taking it actually into an area that's almost criminal procedure as opposed to something. I mean, in most jurisdictions, the prosecution can we've seen alternative theories, right? We think it's intentional murder with malice, and at the very least, it's voluntary manslaughter with provocation, right? That's in the alternative. Most jurisdictions let the government use the alternative of we think it's purposeful murder, but at the very least, it's depraved indifference murder. Now, the great thing that's the reason why prosecutors love that is because the jury thinks depraved indifference murder is a lesser offense than purposeful murder. In most jurisdictions, it's not. It's both murder. Right? So the jury thinks that they're cutting the defendant some slack. Right? They go, well, we don't think he meant to do it, but he did have depraved indifference to human life, and then he's convicted on the same degree of murder. Prosecutors love that. There's actually some. The reason why I said you're taking us into a kind of naughty area. Not naughty, A-U-G-H-T-K-N-O-T-T-Y, a naughty area, is because in New York, there's very anomalous recent cases from the Court of Appeal restricting the ability of the government to argue in the alternative. We think it's purposeful, but if not, it's depraved indifference. That's very anomalous, though. And my guess is the legislature's going to wind up listening. Yeah, and what he appealed on was not on the basis of what we're talking about. He appealed on this issue of intentional murder with the backup being depraved indifference, and the way the appellate court reconciled, because in New York you're not allowed to, if it's really intentional murder and that's your theory, you're not allowed to use depraved indifference as a fallback. That's this anomalous thing about New York that you don't need to know. The way the court reconciled it is the court could have thought that Mondello didn't have the intent to kill, but he did have the intent to inflict serious physical injury, and that would be a form of depraved indifference murder. So that was a way to kind of reconcile the government's argument at the trial with the depraved indifference murder. Okay. Conspiracy. Let's start talking about conspiracy. This Verave case is a great case, I promise, but it takes a little bit of an understanding about some crim pro issues that you don't need to know before they're home safe, but I think you do need to understand at some basic level to understand why the Verave case is kind of cool. So in Verave, the defendant agrees to go to the victim's house and beat him up to try to dissuade him from being a witness against Woodall for perjury, right? And the defendant was supposed to get $900 in a motorcycle in exchange for intimidating this witness, and Woodall was going to pay him this, right? So the defendant goes to the victim's house, he starts beating him up, and then gets interrupted by the victim's son. And he's charged with conspiracy, right? A conspiracy with Woodall. One introductory point, as we've been talking about complicity or accomplice liability, which I keep reminding you is not a separate offense, it is a theory of liability. Conspiracy is a separate offense. So what a defendant is charged with is conspiracy. And he might also be charged with the substantive offense as well if the conspiracy is completed. But conspiracy is a separate offense, and Verave is charged with conspiring. Okay. What are the act elements and the mens rea elements in Verave? What's the actus reus? The government's got to forget.
Going to the victim's house and the second one is getting off.
Oh, so on the evidence, sure. Okay, so. Sorry, as a statutory matter, what does the government have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt?
The act of confirming, so.
What else? What makes this a conspiracy. That sounds more like an attempt. Arnold. And I'm going to call that an overt act to make clear what we're talking about.
Did you repeat again?
Yeah, what's the actus reus of conspiracy?
Agreement.
So the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt there was an agreement, and then an overt act in furtherance of the agreement. And what's mens rea?
Intent.
Intent to what? Okay. So intent to further that, whatever the substantive offense is that they conspire to commit. Okay, so if it's conspiracy to commit murder, there's got to be an intent that the person die. Okay. The overt acts, as Arthur tells us, the evidence of what he actually did was he went to the victim's house and he also hit the victim. The court gets to this issue of what is the overt act requirement in this jurisdiction in a kind of backwards way. And they get there because of these double jeopardy issues and multiple evidence issues. And let's talk about each of those in turn. So first of all, under state law, and the last thing you need to know is crim pro in the state of Arizona. I don't expect you to memorize this as a matter of, you know, for this course. But for purposes of understanding this case, it takes us somewhere important. So in this state, there is an anomalous, and this is very anomalous, there is an anomalous rule in the state that says if the defendant is charged with multiple offenses coming out of the same transaction, charged with multiple offenses coming out of one thing, the government has to prove each of those multiple offenses using separate evidence. That's usually not the case. So if somebody hits a person and that person's also a child, in most states they can be prosecuted for both assault and child abuse based on that same one hit. Hit the person and that same evidence is used for both charges. In this state, however, the government has to point to separate groups of evidence. So if you like Venn diagrams, they're supposed to be able to take the evidence about crime A and the evidence of crime B and have them look different, okay, separate. Okay. Now, based on that, it gets us into a conversation about what the acts are, the overt acts is, for the purpose of conspiracy. They say, because he was charged not only with conspiracy, but also attempt. Well, the court says the evidence of the attempt was hitting the victim. That was an attempt to manipulate the witness. Okay. That was a substantial act in furtherance of that plan to manipulate the witness. What was the overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy? I think, Arthur, you said this earlier. Okay. So in other words, because of this anomalous rule of criminal procedure that in this state that we don't really care about that, it gets us to this important point, which is that going to the house alone would have been enough to prove the overt act for our conspiracy. So just to make sure you guys got that. What if in real life he never gets to hit the victim? The police have found out about the conspiracy. They pull up and arrest the defendant right when he gets out of his car at the house. What could he be charged with? Could he be charged with conspiracy? Yes, right? Could he be charged with attempt? Are you convinced he could be charged with attempt?
Yes, but not both.
Okay, well, certainly not both at that point because of this anomalous rule that says that they've got to point to separate pools of evidence to prove their cases. Look, I guess I'm pausing for a second. How certain are, I think to answer the question, if he gets arrested right when he goes to the house, could he be charged with attempt? I don't think your answer should be a certain yes. Are you guys sure about that? In what type of jurisdiction might he be charged with attempt based on going to the house? Okay, so under the model penal code, going to the house might be a substantial step if the jury thinks it's strongly corroborative of his purpose, right? What about under old common law tests? No, right? I mean, they would have said that's just mere preparation. I mean, if driving around looking for the victim in the payroll is mere preparation. Okay, just going to the house might be mere preparation. Okay. The court's discussion about double jeopardy, okay, I think, also takes us to a place that's important. So for Doug, this time this is the federal approach. Under federal constitutional law, this question of can a person be convicted of two offenses arising out of the same transaction? That's governed by a case called Blockburger. And the Blockburger test says that a defendant can be convicted of multiple charges arising out of the same transaction as long as when you write out the statutory elements of each charge, as long as each statute requires proof of something that the other does not, then both charges can stand. Both convictions can stand. As long as each statute requires proof of something that the other does not, that satisfies Blockburger. So I'm going to take us on a little bit of a tangent here, but I promise there's a payoff. I mentioned before child abuse and assault. So let's say the definition of assault is causing physical injury to another purposefully, knowingly, or recklessly. Misdemeanor assault. The definition of child abuse is causing physical injury to a kid under 14 purposefully, knowingly, or recklessly. Blockburger requires that each statute require proof of something that the other does not. And only then can both convictions stand. If someone injures their kid, who's 12, could they be charged with both child abuse and misdemeanor assault? Each charge has to prove something that the other does not. No, right? Again, if you like Venn diagrams, it's supposed to look like this. You can have some overlap, but each statute has to require proof of something that the other does not. These, if you diagram child abuse and assault, it doesn't look like that. It looks like this. They both require physical injury to another. They both require that it be done purposefully, knowingly, or recklessly. Child abuse requires a child under 14. That doesn't work. Okay. So the defendant, this is called a lesser-included offense. Assault is a lesser-included offense of child abuse. It doesn't satisfy Blockburger. What if instead they hit their kid with a baseball bat? Sorry, that's kind of disturbing. And the definition of assault, too, is causing physical injury. This is a felony assault. Purposefully, knowingly, or recklessly with a deadly weapon. And there's case law in the jurisdiction that says that the baseball bat is a deadly weapon. If someone hit their kid with a baseball bat and they were 12, what could they be convicted of? Yeah.
Assault to and child abuse.
Okay, assault to and child abuse because there's some overlap, right? The overlap is it has to be physical injury, the mens rea, purposefully, knowingly, or recklessly. What they have in common is they both require misdemeanor assault, right? Assault to requires a weapon, child abuse does not. Child abuse requires that the victim be under 14. Assault 2 does not. That satisfies Blockburger. Okay. Where am I going from? If you didn't understand that, the discussion in Verave might not have made any sense. The defendant's argument in Verave is, hey, you can't convict me of both conspiracy an attempt. Because the requirements for conspiracy are an agreement, an act in furtherance of that agreement, and purpose. The elements of attempt are an act in furtherance of the substantive offense and purpose. In other words, he argues that every conspiracy is going to involve an attempt. In other words, attempt is a lesser included offense of conspiracy. You can't convict me of both. The court rejects that argument. Why? Yeah, Peter.
Because the Conspiracy Act is a nominal minimum act, and the act required for attempt is a substantial act.
Okay. The only way to make conspiracy and attempt look the way they're supposed to look is they have a purpose in common. Conspiracy requires an agreement, attempt does not. But attempt has to require proof of something that conspiracy does not. Else it doesn't work. Well, attempt requires an act that's more than mere preparation. It requires kind of a weighty, meaty act, right, in the sense that you need to have an act in order to punish somebody so that you're not punishing guilty intentions alone. What the court says is that a conspiratorial act, this overt act in furtherance of the conspiracy, can be really tiny. It can be the tiniest little act. It can be anything. It doesn't have to be something that is big enough to constitute an attempt. Any little, tiny little act. Even if it wouldn't constitute the last step, even if it wouldn't constitute a substantial step. Something really small. Well, how do you reconcile that with everything we talked about in our attempt study? When we talked about how the law is protective of people because you're allowed to think about your crimes, you're allowed to have guilty intentions. It's only when you act that the criminal law will punish you. Here the court is saying, oh, it could just be this little tiny, tiny act. Presumably even driving to the house, not even arriving there. Presumably even getting in the car with the intention to drive to the house would be enough. Why does that satisfy the constitutional requirement that there be an act? Or are you guys all against conspiracy prosecution? That there's enough of an act to prosecute that person, there's enough of an act to justify prosecution. Eric said the overt act in proving a conspiracy is actually not the focus of the actus reus at all. The focus of the actus reus for conspiracy is agreement. And in fact, many jurisdictions don't even require an overt act. Many jurisdictions, the only actus reus is agreement. Most jurisdictions require an overt act. But many do not. Many do not. It's only the agreement. Eric, let me ask you this. If I sit at home and think about robbing a bank, can I be punished? If you sit at home and think about robbing a bank, can you be punished? Why are we punishable once we communicate that to each other and say, okay, let's do it?
More of a threat when you're that.
Thank you. Okay, so we talked about this before, that when we started getting into complicity, solicitation, we talked about solicitation. The assumption of the criminal law that there's something dangerous about multiple parties sharing their culpable intention. If I'm a mere attempter, if it's just me and my guilty intention, I can't be prosecuted for guilty intentions. I can't even be prosecuted for a little tiny, tiny, tiny step to start to plan that, to start to go towards it. It's only when I've committed a substantial step under the Model Penal Code that I can be prosecuted, and then, of course, the common law was much more protective even beyond that. But even the common law was quick to recognize that if Eric and I share our intentions together and say, okay, let's do it, that agreement in and of itself became dangerous. We lose. If I'm an attempter, I can control myself. I may not go through with it. Let's wait and see how much Burke does to see whether we should punish her or not. The assumption of conspiracy law is that the minute the two of us convey that to each other and we know that someone else is in on this, we're more likely to go through with it. Me as an individual and Eric as an individual, it becomes this collective thing that neither one of us can control the way we can control ourselves on our own. It's all about group behavior. Okay, so the heart of the actus reus in a conspiracy is the agreement. In jurisdictions that require an overt act, and many of them do not require an overt act, the act is very small. It does not have to be an act that would rise to the level of an attempt, and it doesn't have to be committed by the defendant himself. So if Eric and I strike an agreement to rob a bank, and the next day he goes and buys ski masks to be used, and we're in a jurisdiction that requires an overt act and an agreement, his purchase of the ski mask binds us both. Okay, that's an overt act sufficient to make me guilty of conspiracy as well. So the overt act, if it's required at all, I'm going to put it in parentheses because many jurisdictions don't even require an overt act. It can be a small act, less than an attempt, and by any conspirator. It doesn't have to be by the defendant himself. By any conspirator. While we're on this subject, because we were talking about Blockburger, could a defendant be convicted of conspiracy to commit murder and murder, the substantive offense? It's a constitutional matter. Because each requires something the other does not. What does conspiracy to commit murder require that murder does not? An agreement, right? You can murder someone by yourself. You don't need to have a conspiracy for that. So you've got to have an agreement. What does murder require that conspiracy to commit murder doesn't require? A dead body, right? So... So, as a constitutional matter, the government can always prosecute somebody both for conspiracy and the completed substantive offense if it's completed. If it's not completed, they could prosecute for conspiracy and attempt. The one caveat here is just, it's a little tiny detail, but I thought if that strikes you as unfair, the Supreme Court disagrees with you. But the Model Penal Code is not. If you look at Model Penal Code 1.07, as a matter of policy, the Model Penal Code doesn't get to rewrite Blockburger. But as a matter of policy, the Model Penal Code at 1.071B, the top of page 1037, if you're looking in your appendix, it says prosecution for multiple offenses. When the same conduct of a defendant may establish the commission of more than one offense, the defendant may be prosecuted for each such offense. He may not, however, be convicted of more than one offense if one offense consists only of a conspiracy or other form of preparation to commit the other. Okay, so as a matter of fairness, the Model Penal Code gets rid of some of this duplicity, you know, double prosecutions, double offenses. Just as a matter of policy. Okay, so the heart of conspiracy is agreement. Some jurisdictions require an overt act. If it's an overt act requirement, it can be small act, and by any co-conspirator, doesn't have to be the defendant. What about in a COA? In a COA, could they, well, except there were two of those. In Tally, could they have charged Tally with conspiring to murder with the Skelton brothers? BJ?
In conspiracy, well, because the air has to get an agreement, but he could get an agreement with the three four brothers.
Why?
There was no meeting, there was no communication, so there can't be an agreement.
Okay, so the Skelton brothers don't even know that Tally is doing this. They can't agree. Very good. So there'd have to be proof that there was an agreement and that Tally was part of it. What about the Skelton brothers with each other? Yes, right? Okay. They would almost certainly, there'd be enough evidence to prove agreement. And let's look at very quickly how the government might prove agreement. Let's look at Griffin versus Dave. I read this case, and sometimes I can't help but read it with kind of a critical race lens. It's in Arkansas, the written opinion is in 1970, which means the conduct happened earlier than that. And I don't know, I just had to point that out, but one wonders about this recitation of facts. But if you believe this recitation of facts, a driver gets into a car accident, he wrecks his car, and the police officers respond and are just trying to be helpful. And he, for no reason, starts to attack them, and then this crowd of people around from the neighborhood all then attack these poor police officers also when they're trying to defend themselves. And the issue is whether all of these people who were in the neighborhood who suddenly came together, if they suddenly swarmed together and attacked these police officers, whether that was sufficient evidence for a conspiracy. And to be clear, it would be very different if there was any evidence at all to suggest that these people had met in advance and the whole car accident was a ruse to draw the police officers out and they were going to attack them. That was not, no one said that that's how it happened, right? The accident happened. The driver got into a fight with the police officers, and all of a sudden, the neighborhood jumped in. Where is the evidence of an agreement? How can there be agreement if they're just doing it all of a sudden?
Non-verbal, spontaneous communication.
Okay. The agreement can be tacit. And I sort of... Now, there's two different points I want to make that are a little different. One is you might suspect an explicit agreement, but there's no evidence of that, right? To prove the agreement, you can only prove it one of two ways. One is you can prove it directly. Someone testifies that they heard the agreement. Who's that likely to be? Who's likely to testify about direct evidence of conspiracy? Where did the evidence of this verity come from? The dude who hired him, right? Woodall. Right? Woodall's the one who tells on verity. So if you get direct evidence from one of the co-conspirators, one of the co-conspirators might say, yeah, it was a dark and stormy night on October 12th, and that's when we struck our agreement. We said, let's go do this. And you might have testimony about the explicit conspiracy, the explicit agreement. Short of that direct testimony of an explicit agreement, you might have to prove it through inference, and yet still be saying that there was an explicit agreement, right? One suspects that the Skelton brothers had an explicit agreement. They said, let's go kill that SOB who seduced our sister, right? We suspect they had an explicit agreement. We might not be able to flip one of them to prove it. They might not be able to say it was on that dark and stormy night when we agreed. How would we prove that they had an explicit agreement, though? Yeah.
Circumstantial evidence?
Like what?
the plot is together.
Yeah, everything they're doing is together. Their conduct is in concert. They are going to the next town, all on horseback, all sharing the same intention. From that, the jury might infer they had an agreement. They had an explicit agreement. We might not have testimony about the words that were used, but for them to have acted jointly like this, they must have had an explicit agreement. And we'll talk about Zacharias and Sally, because I think that indictment was written with an eye towards arguing a conspiracy of some kind, right? Showing his alignment and movement with the hijackers and all of that. The argument is, look at how he's working in tandem. Look at how their conduct goes together. They must have agreed to that in order for it to be so synchronized. That is not what the government was arguing in Griffin. Griffin gives us a look at a case that says you can have an agreement that's not explicit, that it's tacit. So it's not a case where they were saying because they acted together, they must have expressly agreed. Instead, the theory is that without words, only through joint conduct, the agreement gets expressed without words. That this group all together did this thing and found comfort in each other, agreed with each other without words to share in this assault from the police officers. The best example I've heard of an everyday tacit conspiracy that you might be familiar with is, how many of you have ever taken a road trip, like a really, really long road trip? That's it? Come on! You guys aren't that sheltered. Give me a break. Okay, so many of us have been on long cross-country road trips. Have you ever found yourself noticing that another car is driving with you? Am I the only person that's had that happen? But you notice in your rearview mirror that there's a red Toyota that's been with you on the road for miles and miles and miles. This doesn't ring a bell. Huh?
Especially when it's dark.
Especially when it's dark. When there's not a lot of cars around, you notice that you're in tandem with somebody else. Have you ever, if that's happened to you, do you notice that you speed a little bit more? I mean, this is maybe not, I don't know, I read this in a book, and I nodded my head when I read it, so I can't be the only person who's experienced this. But there is a phenomenon, if you're a long-distance driver, that you might drive 75 miles an hour left to your own devices, but if there's another car that's kind of piggybacks with you, you might both wind up going a little faster. If one stops for gas, the other one might stop for gas. You don't talk to each other, but one slows down, the other one slows down. You wind up traveling together without ever communicating with each other. Some of you think I'm insane, apparently. Some of you are nodding your head. If you can even imagine that. That has been used as an example, not just by me, but by whoever made it up, whose name I'm forgetting, as an example of a tacit conspiracy. That without ever talking to each other, you kind of find comfort in each other, and you sort of agree without talking about it to go just a little faster, slow down in traffic zones where there might be police officers, right? Slam on your brakes and you see the cops and speed back up later. But you never lose sight of each other, and then when they pull off, you know, oh, there goes my red Toyota, and you're by yourself again. Tacit conspiracy. And Griffin, I think, is just an example of such a case. Okay, but again, distinguish that from, there could be an express agreement that is proven circumstantially. It doesn't matter in the end whether it's tacit or express. What matters is that the government proves an agreement. Okay? All right. Questions on that?
Yeah. So, the government could have proposed that theory for Mandela, that this 30-person mob, some most of the facts, one guy with a gun, and we knew that we were acting independently, they could have had a tacit agreement, and they could have actually had a conspiracy.
Yes.
But that might be applicable.
You could argue that this mob, in the Yusuf Hawkins case, reached a conspiracy, not just at first, right? When you say get them and take the bath, they take the bath of accepting the agreement, but other people who jump in and start running, sure.
I don't know, like, should they really charge Griffin? Like, should they just charge the crowd? Because Griffin was kind of by himself being crazy.
Well, you can't charge a crowd, right? So you have to charge individual members of the crowd. You can try them jointly. But you've got to prove the elements of the offense against each of them. So you have to argue that each one of them is a member of the conspiracy.
You know, I don't think, I'm sure that when he started swinging or whatever he was doing, he didn't intend to defy with the cow. Like, they just kind of like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point is that, and maybe to take us back to David's point about if we talk about conspiracy and the use of Hawkins facts, it doesn't matter whether it's Mondello whose idea it is to come up with this conspiracy and gets everybody together and says, let's do this, and hands out the bat, or whether it's somebody who just sees this, likes this, wants to join in, and starts running along too. They are both guilty of conspiracy. Whether you're the person who came up with this or whether you're the person who at the tail end says, okay, I'm in too, what matters is you're all part of the same agreement. It makes you all culpable. Okay, all culpable of conspiracy. Look at U.S. versus Massawi. The excerpts of his indictment, page 806 to 808. Clearly, this is not all of the government's allegations, just excerpts of a much longer indictment. But hopefully you have a chance to read it closely enough to get a feel for what they were alleging. And at one point when they originally filed this indictment, the government's theory was that he was the missing 20th hijackers on September 11th. You know, there was a total of 19 hijackers. All the planes had five, except one only had four, and the theory was it was probably supposed to have five too, whatever happened to that guy. They now think the 20th hijacker is somebody else. But at first, the theory was that Zacharias and Sally was the missing 20th hijacker. What in this indictment ties him to them? And this isn't that many allegations, but there's enough there to start to begin to connect the dots between him and the hijackers.
He had some flight training, and he purchased the videos, he attended schools, so from the evidence that I think the jury could infer that he was capable of piloting an airplane just like the other terrorists.
Okay, so there's a parallel in conduct, right? Like them, he contacted flight schools, he took classes, he bought, video replicas of flights, he purchased knives, right? The parallels in conduct around the same time period, right, just before September 11th when the others were planning as well, these parallels in conduct. What else? Presumably, we're not going to charge, well, maybe we would have at the time. We shouldn't charge every Muslim person who ever was in flight school. Right? So what else is there? Okay. So there's these wire transfers internationally between Zacharias Massawi and Ramzi bin al-Sheikh. Right? So look at paragraph 65. Who's that? Why should we care about him? And a wire transfer from him to Massawi. No. But he did wire money to them, right? So go back into the earlier paragraphs. Right? Paragraph 14, Ramzi bin al-Sheikh was part of the terrorist cell of Muhammad Atta. Wired money to one of the hijackers, paragraph 21. Wired money, paragraph 25. One of the hijackers attempts to enroll Ramzi bin al-Sheikh to a flight school in Florida. That's a huge connection. They've got Ramzi bin al-Sheikh very connected to the hijackers, right? They've got his fingerprints all over that stuff. And then they've got this very guy wiring money to Zacharias himself. That's compelling. Nothing in here about direct. There's no testimony here. It's not like they are flipping one of these people and they're saying, oh yeah, we know Massawi and we had an agreement with him. It's the parallels in conduct. Right? It's the parallels in conduct. And from that, the government would argue they had to be in on this together. Now, the difficulty in the Massawi case was figuring out, well, a conspiracy to do what? Was he meant to be the 20th hijacker? Was he part of a separate conspiracy to fly a plane into something else? Conspiracy to commit what was a little more amorphous, a little less known. But hopefully that gives you some idea of how these prosecutions work. They point to the parallels in conduct, they connect the dots between different people, and then argue backwards from that, that there must have been an agreement. I think it's probably don't have enough time to do People versus Laria. One thing I wanted to tell you. We asked about whether, I asked you whether if tally there could be evidence of a conspiracy. I wanted to make sure everybody got the difference between them. So somebody could aid and abet somebody and not be a conspirator. Right? We talked about that. What's the difference between solicitation and conspiracy? Okay, so a solicitation doesn't have to be accepted, right? You can try to look at somebody and they can say no and you don't have an agreement. One person would be guilty of solicitation, the other person would be guilty of nothing. If the person who is solicited accepts, at that point you have an agreement. Then the only question is whether the jurisdiction requires an overt act. If they require an overt act, there has to be an overt act. I was reading, part of me doesn't want to talk about it. I'm nervous. I guess I'm not that superstitious. Do you guys remember during the Democratic convention in Denver, they arrested those meth heads for supposedly threatening Barack Obama? Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
It's like very little news story. So they arrested 3 people, I think, who were like meth head biker type people, and they wanted to get to Barack Obama, according to one of their statements to the police, and one of them even went and bought weapons for this purpose. Well, the U.S. attorney in Denver has declined to prosecute them, saying that, and not for conspiracy to commit murder, there's a separate federal statute that makes it a crime to threaten a president. And he said that he couldn't prosecute them because there was no proof that they could actually carry out the threat. Now, you guys have had criminal law for 10 weeks. Does that sound right to you? Okay, well, who just said no, that doesn't sound right? The statute prohibits threatening the president. He's saying, I can't prosecute them for conspiracy to threaten the president because there was no proof that they could actually carry out their plan. Yeah, if you look at the elements of the statute, it's a form of inchoate crime, right? They don't want to have, the government doesn't want to have to prove that someone was actually going to carry it out. The crime is threatening the president. There doesn't have to be proof that they actually want to carry out the threat. If somebody is prosecuted for conspiracy to commit murder, does the government have to prove that they could have actually carried out the crime? What if A and B conspire to commit murder and they're going to do it by buying a voodoo doll and sticking it with him? Okay. As a matter of prosecuting conspiracy, it doesn't require that the conspiracy can actually be carried out. It could be the craziest plan ever. All it requires is agreement and purpose. Now, the Model Penal Code permits as a matter of sentencing discretion. It tells the judge that if the plan was so flawed that it was never going to come to fruition, that they can take that into account in terms of whether or not to punish. But in terms of the elements of the offense, it doesn't matter if it's a crazy plan. What matters is whether there's an agreement, an overt act, and the intent to further that. Oh, the other thing is, what might a jury do if it was so nutty that it was A and B are going to buy a voodoo doll, and that's how they're going to kill their nemesis? What might a jury do with that case? They're all skeptical.
I'm not sure about the jury, but the defense could be a legal impossibility. I'm not so sure that necessarily impossible. Maybe it is possible.
Well, except legal impossibility is not really a defense to something like attempt, because what matters is the defense's mental state. If the facts are they believe them to be, that would constitute an attempt, it would be an attempt. So I don't think that's quite right. If you were the defense attorney in that case, what might you think? You might think that the jury's going to think that's a stupid case. How might you argue it to them to try to get your client off? Yes. Why isn't that a real agreement if they say, let's go buy a food all together? Okay. Okay, and if they don't really think it could work,
then there's really no agreement.
Well, there's an agreement. It's not an attempt. Right? It's an agreement to play with a voodoo doll. Right? So I think that the argument, the Model Penal Code's comments on this, they actually use the voodoo doll exception, so this is not one of my crazy hypotheticals, this is one of their crazy hypotheticals, is they think that, one, a prosecutor wouldn't really prosecute that because they're not dangerous, and two, even if some prosecutor did prosecute that, a jury would be sensible enough to say, well, they didn't really have the purpose because they should know that they can't get somebody with a voodoo doll. Okay, that shows they didn't really have the purpose, they were just playing around. Okay. Conspiracy is highly inchoate. We're going to talk more about what courts have done to sort of provide some protections to would-be conspirators, like in Laria. Okay, so we'll take up Laria. But it's highly inchoate. I'm sure you remember after September 11th, it seemed like people were getting arrested left and right for conspiracies to do various terrorist acts. I think two guys were arrested because they had drawings of New York landmarks. Right, and there was reason to believe they had extreme beliefs against the United States, and that was the basis for arguing conspiracy. Because conspiracy can be highly inchoate. Many jurisdictions don't even require any kind of overt act. It's just the agreement and intent. Okay, so really, all of our inchoate crimes that we've been looking at, they all stretch this act requirement that we talked about the first week of class. Conspiracy does it by punishing just the agreement. All right, I hope you don't mind. I'm going to go a little bit early today. I appreciate it. Go watch the polls. Does anybody have anything to report? Has anybody been peeved? Okay, you're not supposed to.
Kane has
date
of bonus.
What?
Kane is
what date?
You want to talk to Kentucky and Obama
They announced Kentucky, and they haven't been able to announce Indiana? Interesting. Might be a long night. Although I think I read something that said, it's so funny, like they don't even have any exit results to talk about, so all they can do is like talk about what you might talk about. So Chuck Todd was saying if they couldn't call Indiana quickly, if they couldn't call Indiana and Kentucky quickly, it would be a bad night for McCain. But it sounded like they did at least call No, they didn't have that. I think that they said that they weren't going to discuss any exit polls until the polls closed. Yeah, so in each state. So. Go vote if you haven't voted. Did people vote? I guess you have to vote in the day. Did you have time to vote? I hope so. Oh, I'm sorry. Next week. So no class Thursday. I wrote this down. I was actually organized. Hold on a second. Tuesday. Sorry. No class on Thursday. Read the rest of blocks 26 and 27. for Tuesday, and then I will put up on Twin the rest of the reading for the semester for starting on Thursday.
Thank you. Thank you. before, so it's easy to put that
one way for the summer in one class, so it would change classes and do it with the fact that everyone has to come back. I just want to know, I don't think they want to do it.
I'm not saying we don't take it hard.